Hello, I'm Matthew Bradbury, and welcome to The Beverage Report, a student-led podcast ran out of the London School of Economics, Department of Economics.
The financial crisis caused GDP to shrink by 6%. It took 5 years to recover and is seen as one of the most damaging events to the UK in the last 100 years. Today, we sit down with Alistair Darling, the Chancellor of the Exchequer during that period, and talk to him about the response from the Treasury and from the government. We talk about the impact of the crisis, the scars it left on the UK, and we draw from his experience as chair of the board of the Better Together campaign.
First question, what was it about 2008 that made it the worst financial crisis for a century? Like, why is it that this is the thing that's mentioned in the same breath as the Great Depression?
The difference 10 years ago was that it wasn't just one bank or one country's banks that were threatened with ruin. It was the entire banking system of the developed world. I don't think people had fully realised just how interconnected the entire system was. You know, in times past, a bank could go down, or two or three banks could go down. That would be a tragedy for the particular area in which they operated, but that would be it. Whereas by 2007, if you take Northern Rock, for example, it failed because of a loss of confidence in the US subprime mortgage market. And yet, thousands of miles away, it destroyed a bank in the northeast of England. So I think it was the fact that this was a global financial crisis as opposed to an individual or regional crisis. That's what made the difference, and that's what made it such a grave situation.
Okay. So you talk about Northern Rock there, and this was bailed out. I was just wondering, what were the other policy options on the table at the time? So what were the things that you considered that doing that weren't bailout? For example, extending the level of debt that was... extending the deposit protection scheme and just allowing the people to kind of like have their money, but then not bailing out the shareholders.
The thing about Northern Rock is that it got into trouble really in the summer of 2007, and the Bank of England prepared the conventional response as lender of last resort, and that is it would have ensured that Northern Rock had enough money to carry on. The difference in 2007 from times past is that when it became apparent, because the story was leaked to the BBC, that Northern Rock was going to be bailed out, rather than people saying, oh good, isn't it great the Bank of England is standing behind it, our money is safe, quite the opposite happened. They started queuing up and demanding to get their money out. And because Northern Rock is a small bank, typically its branches have two or three people behind the counter, and they all tried to persuade the customers to leave their money in, so the queues built up. This appeared on 24-hour television, and you know the crisis looked like it was getting worse and worse. So the conventional responses, which is the Bank of England, and frankly the Bank of England is colossal compared to Northern Rock, that didn't work, nor was assurances that your money is safe, that didn't work. And really, we were in a situation where we had to let that burn out, if you like, over the weekend. And it wasn't until the following Monday and Tuesday, after the Friday it was announced, that basically people who wanted the money out, it got it out. And everybody else was quite happy to leave it there. So what are the things, the particular characteristics of the crisis in 2007, is that the normal things that would reassure people, savers and markets didn't work because people had lost confidence.
Okay, so you talk about... So almost one regard that we were lucky with the financial crisis is that you have Northern Rock going 2007 and then afterwards RBS. So a lot in your book, you talk about how procedures which were developed to deal with Northern Rock then came in again for RBS. So basically, how did this dry run, this kind of smaller bank going wrong, enable things to be done a lot easier the second time around?
And I said many times before, if it hadn't been for Northern Rock, I do sometimes wonder how we would have dealt with the imminent collapse of RBS, which at that time was the biggest bank in the world. And had RBS gone down, it would have brought the entire banking system crashing down within hours. And with Northern Rock, you know, we learned the lessons. The first is that conventional reassuring measures like lending of last resort facilities don't always provide the confidence you'd hope for. In retrospect, had we had the legislation to simply take hold of, effectively nationalise Northern Rock over the weekend, which we implemented in 2008, so that's why the problem didn't arise again. You know, that taught us if you're going to do something, you've got to do more than people expect, and you've got to do it more quickly than they expect. So when in October of 2008 we're faced with the RBS crisis, because we announced a massive bailout, and you know hundreds of millions of pounds of loan facilities and so on, and because we were able to announce it the next morning, it provided a firewall, if you like. And you know, I'm not saying that it was guaranteed, because we didn't know whether it would work or not, but it did in fact stop the crisis. Now, of course, other things followed, because when we did it, the Americans, the Eurozone, they did the same things as well. So people could see that all over the world you had a similar response. But the crucial thing is, if you're going to spend all that money on bailing out a banking system, in addition to commentators' support, you need public support. And I think in many ways, when they saw what had happened with a, you know, in the scheme of things, Northern Rock was a small regional bank. When they saw what had happened then, I think people then understood why we could not allow the same thing to happen with RBS and indeed every other British bank for that matter.
Mm-hmm. So you talk there about the kind of speed of response, the things could be done by Monday. So I was wondering, how do you think the cabinet system, wherein you and Gordon Brown, you mentioned, were broadly on the same side for dealing for bailing out these banks, how do you think that the cabinet system allowed quick response, whereas in America, you have the like congressional system and a kind of a more slower process to make getting laws made?
Well, the fact we could decide things overnight made the difference between it working and just falling flat on its face. And the American, because America's so big, its constitution is well understood that you've got to go and argue with Congress and so on. You know, it eventually worked its way through. But the way that the British constitution works is, you know, because it's very much modelled on cabinet government, but within the cabinet government, ministers, individual secretaries of state, and of course in a thing like this, the prime minister, obviously, can make decisions. I mean, the only two cabinet ministers who knew about this were me and Gordon Brown, because, you know, you can't really have discussions with things. And, you know, if any of this had leaked in advance, the whole thing would have just, it just wouldn't have worked. Now, obviously, we are answerable in that on the day I announced it, obviously, it had to be announced first thing in the morning because of markets and so on, and we couldn't afford the risk of panic building up during the day. But I had to go to the House of Commons in the afternoon, and you know, there are ways in which the Commons can, if they don't like what you're doing, they can stop you in your tracks. But in fact, despite a bit of huffing and puffing and ritual opposition, actually, people couldn't see what else we should be doing. So it worked. So we are answerable. But, you know, if we'd had the American system, the banks would have collapsed, because by the time everybody agreed, it would have been too late. And equally, in the Eurozone, you know, I'm well disposed towards Europe, their decision-making at times is painfully slow. In fact, I think we might be discussing it yet. So our system does work, but it does work, provided everybody's got confidence that actually at the end of the day you are accountable. Mm.
One of the first things that Labour did in 1997 was to make the Bank of England independent. So that's one example there of where this decision-making process has been pushed further from the Cabinet. So how do you think that changed your remit to fight this crisis?
Well, remember, the independence we gave the Bank of England was only in regard to monetary policy, the setting of interest rates. And, of course, the Cabinet never got... No Cabinet's ever been consulted on that. It was always the Chancellor of the Exchequer that decided. So what the Bank of England had was the autonomy to decide whether interest rates go up or down. When it came to bank rescues, it cannot operate on its own because, frankly, its balance sheet isn't big enough. And, you know, there were numerous times during the crisis I had to guarantee the Bank of England, because the governor said he needed that guarantee, that we would see them right for whatever funds they had. Now, as it happens, with the exception of RBS share, the actual shares, which have not recovered and are probably unlikely to recover from where they were, all the other money that we put in, we got back. Mm-hmm. And actually the government made a profit on some of it, because the banks quite rightly had to pay for the facilities they were getting. The British government, its credit, no one questions. The British government has not defaulted on its debts for 400 years. And that's very important. You know, when on the night that RBS was faced with collapse, we had to keep it going, but we also had to make sure the Americans would keep it going in America the following day. And nobody in the US Fed ever said to the Bank of England, who's paying for all this? How do we know you'll see us right? They just trusted us. Mm. And I suppose that leads to another question. Without the international cooperation here, the whole thing would have been impossible. And you do have to ask in 2020 whether or not you'd get that international cooperation today. I just don't know.
Mm. One thing that you say there, so you say that international cooperation is important and that the Fed had this backed. And yet, Lehman Brothers, it was the case that Barclays, a British bank, was lined up to support it. And yet, kind of at the last moment, the British government stepped in and stopped the purchase. So I was wondering how does that square with this depiction of international cooperation?
Well, international cooperation, firstly, it doesn't mean you do whenever anybody asks. It does mean that where you've got a common interest that you act together. The Lehman's thing was all very last minute. Mm. It was, along with other American banks, in difficulties. And basically, the American government tried on the weekend before to put together a deal. But, you know, briefly put, the other American banks didn't want to know about it for various reasons. And then Barclays were clearly after the good bits of Lehman Brothers. But the problem is that if Barclays had taken over, Barclays is a British bank. Ultimately, the British government would be standing behind it. And I could not foresee the circumstances in which any British Chancellor of the Exchequer would say, I'll stand behind a British bank that is about to buy an American bank that by Monday morning will be bust, because we'll be taking on the debts and all the obligations of an American bank, which the British taxpayers have got precious little connection with. And it just wouldn't do. And of course, there was other things we were asking about. OK, suppose this went ahead. What you're asking us to do is to waive the shareholders' rights, Barclays shareholders' rights, to object. Now, that's like expropriating people's property. You can't do that. And equally, there were no guarantees or anything like that. So the deal was just, it was a non-starter. Mm. And actually, we told the Americans, you know, at the start of the whole proceedings that we thought it was a non-starter, although it wasn't until a Sunday. I know that on the other side of the Atlantic in America, there is a view that, you know, we could have done something, but I think you only take that view if you're wholly indifferent to the position the British taxpayer would have taken.
Yeah. So talking about America there was this article in The Economist recently which basically talked about a village where they'd mapped the location of that village versus the flooding of the river next to it. So the river would flood, everyone would move all of the way up the hill, and then generation after generation, they'd forget about the flood, and the village would kind of slowly seep back again. So the kind of point here is that, like, when generational knowledge of a crisis is forgotten and mistakes are made and you see yourself moving closer to that river again. So one example people often point to for America is that the massive home ownership expansion under Clinton, and then you get the lowering of interest rates by the Fed, which kind of pushes investment in riskier assets. I was wondering if, so before the crisis, you have a decade-long growth under Labour. Do you think in this there are any regards where the village moved closer to the river and systemic risks were allowed in because it just been so long since the last crisis?
I think you have to appreciate the value of what you might call institutional knowledge, because when the last person retires or goes who was around 10 years ago, and you've got a new generation who don't, they may have read about it and they may have heard it talked about, but they weren't there. Mm. Then as time goes on, their awareness of what can happen if things go wrong, or that sometimes when things look too good to be true, there's a reason for it, then, you know, that's a problem. And I can take a different example here. When the railway system was privatised in the 1990s, the people that knew how to run the railways got sacked and were replaced by people who knew how to put shopping malls up and stations. And that meant that, you know, the new generation didn't realise that when it rains, the tracks get wet and trains go slower because they take some longer to brake. And tragically, you know, it ended up with some pretty disastrous, you know, not just some bad accidents, but of course, rail track eventually collapsed. A lot of that was due to the fact that people who knew about these things had gone. Now, you'd like to think that the new generation coming into banking, finance and so on will have learnt, have been taught, you know, about the culture. But I don't think you can, you've just got to keep reminding people that, you know, it's all these things can go wrong. And the difference in the financial system and a company that's making, you know, rivets or cars or something is if the financial system goes down, it tends to bring everything down on top of it.
And also, I imagine you can read about a crisis, but it's very different to having those phone calls at 3 a.m.
Yeah, you know, if you've been there, And, you know, when I was phoned and told that RBS had less than 3 hours left before it ran out of money, you know, it's a bit of a shock to the system, but, you know, partly because of my Northern Rock experience, partly because we'd been thinking about these things, you could deal with it. Now, I won't ever be in that position again for obvious reasons, but if you've been there and you know how to react, because, you know, when we got that call, you know, there's some things had to be done very quickly, like telling the Bank of England you must keep this thing afloat, the Americans and so on. You don't have time to sit down and panic. You just got to get on with it.
Yeah.
And experience, I'm not always saying experience is always, you know, the absolutely essential, but it does help, I think.
Yeah. I want to go back to the point about the Bank of England, where we were talking about that it had independence. Now, to quote from the book here, you say that the governor, using an elegant metaphor of a minister who could preach to his congregation but did not have the power to do what he wanted, called for greater powers to be given to the Bank of England. Everyone knew what he was getting at. It was a naked attempt to wrest powers from the FSA. So why is it... So the justification for the Bank of England being made independent was that isolating monetary policy means that you don't have stop-and-go policies, wherein the electoral cycle can be separated from the economic cycle. So why would that be... Why is it that that's best limited to monetary policy, but things like the FSA should not be made independent?
Well, I think there's a number of things there. Firstly, at the time, when the Bank of England was clearly responsible for monetary policy, but it was also responsible for the financial stability of the system. Where it had broken down is that the FSA and that part of the bank were not as closely aligned as they should have been. Now, since then, of course, the system has been changed. The Bank of England is in charge of everything, but in practice, the Prudential Regulatory Authority does a prudential supervision, and you've got the FCA, which deals with, you know, everything else, basically. And, you know, we'll only know whether or not it works, you know, if we have another crisis. But I wouldn't argue for changing the system just now. In regard to making, whether it was the FSA or the Prudential Regulatory Authority or the FSA, independent, as you put it. Yes, they are, in the sense that, you know, they decide on the regulatory requirements within the law, of course. They can require on, you know, capital adequacy, on liquidity and so on. At the end of the day, though, if you have another crisis, the only institution that is big enough to deal with this is the government. And if you take what you might loosely call, you know, the dispatch box risks, where someone's going to go and explain all this, at the end of the day, that comes back to the Chancellor. Now, one of the changes that was made in the legislation, well, just under 10 years ago now, was that it's now clear the Chancellor of the Exchequer is ultimately responsible and can take and order the necessary action to be taken. And because it's public money, because there's clearly a public interest with regard to the financial system, I think that must be the right answer. So you're never going to get, if you like, true independence. True independence only comes if you know, if the Bank of England and the other bodies happen to have pots of money, which obviously they won't and don't.
So in the same light, you wouldn't make, say, the Department of Education independent and also run by technocrats?
Well, the Department of Education, rather like, you know, other government parts, are there to advise the minister. So, you know, they're not executive arms. You know, there's lots of, you know, like health and safety, for example, executive arms, but and they're independent too. And, you know, and certainly in things like prosecutions and so on, you should always have that well away from politicians. But as far as, you know, where public money is concerned and public confidence, you've got to ask yourself at the end of the day, okay, whose fault was it? Who's answerable for this? And, you know, in something that's really big, like, you know, another global financial crisis, the answer is the government and the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Kind of keeping this tied with how the system of government works and just talking about the cabinet system, one thing that you do say in the book is that for 13 years there was not an effective cabinet system, and this wasn't a mistake that should be repeated. I was wondering, what was it about the system? What were the strengths of cabinet, do you think, that weren't relied upon or weren't used as well as they could have been?
Well, the strength of a cabinet is you've got 20 or so people sitting around the table, all looking at a problem from slightly different views, different experiences, and they contribute to it, and hopefully the outcome is you get a better policy as a result. Politically, the advantage is all you know, 20-odd people are then tied into it. Having reached a collective decision, it's yours. Whereas if it's taken by two or three people, then you don't feel that ownership and not necessarily the loyalty to it. I mean, you know, more recently you've seen that in Brexit over the last three years or so. But I think, you know, cabinet government ought to work, and that the Prime Minister, and it's up to him or her to pick those people that they trust and they value for whatever reason, and then rely on them. Now, of course, in some things, you know, I've mentioned the financial crisis where, you know, in our time, it was the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, Gordon and me, who knew about it, and it wasn't discussed widely. But, you know, other things like, you know, tuition fees, for example, or, you know, the Iraq, all these are things where, you know, frankly, collective discussion benefits. We don't have a presidential system here. And, you know, it worries me that, you know, if you get to a situation where you cut people out, if you don't want them in, then put them out and get somebody else in. You know, I think the system only works. And remember, the Prime Minister is first amongst equals. He or she is not the president.
One thing that's interesting in this book is that you talk a lot about... So you talk in the end about the 2010 election when you're out campaigning, and you're accosted by a voter who's complaining about how immigrants are ruining this country. It's kind of interesting reading this now, because concerns about immigration is seen as one of the largest things about... one of the largest causes of Brexit. So do you think that this kind of top-down government system, which ended up happening in the cabinet, stops kind of fringe issues like immigration coming up, being debated upon?
Well, immigration is not a fringe issue. It's you know, it's pretty much there and has been for, I don't know, most of the last century and this. I think that the way the system ought to work is, you know, we elect 650 MPs, all of whom come with different experiences from different parts of the country. And although our government is cabinet government, if you like, MPs have various ways in which they can make their views known, whether it's internally through their party they belong to, or, you know, in votes in the House of Commons and so on. What I think, you know, you look at an issue like immigration, it really depends on where you're looking from and what your perceptions are. And I think the real problem, you know, which contributed quite substantially to the Brexit vote, is not just immigration in itself, but a feeling that the world was changing, and changing for the worse for many, you know, towns and villages where businesses, you know, firms that had been there in the past had gone. It appeared to be moving into the cities. They looked at what's happening in London and the South East, and they compare it with, say, the North East of England. You know, these are big structural problems, you know, which, you know, I think it's fair to say that successive governments have tried in their various ways to do something about it. But, you know, I think they haven't succeeded in the sense that they haven't satisfied people, that there isn't more that can be done. You know, we'll wait and see what happens in the next 4 years. I have my doubts whether all the problems that are currently being raised are going to be able to tackle them. You know, it give you an example. It is, you know, beyond doubt that the rail links and the road links, particularly in the English Midlands and the north of England, need improved. I was a transport minister for 4 years. I can tell you it's very easy to announce a project, but usually they take years, if not decades, to deliver. You know, HS2 is a case in point. It will not get to the north of England for another 20 or 30 years, if ever. So I think, you know, the answer is a long answer to your question, but, you know, Parliament needs to be responsive to all the issues raised by people, but immigration is one where, you know, if we see the world over, it is a big, big issue, and which, you know, I don't think we have answered yet.
You talk there that a lot of the cause for Brexit is this discontentment with the status quo. Do you think that's the same kind of notion which is driving the push for a second independence referendum in Scotland?
Yeah, to some extent, yes. And if you ask people, what do you want? What you've got now or something better? Most people say, well, we'll go for the something better option. And the thing about referendums is that something better is never specified. You see, the reason we've got all the problems of Brexit just now is nobody ever had a plan B. And similarly, you know, one of the reasons the Nationalists failed in 2014 in Scotland is because they didn't have a plan. And, you know, what they did, you know, was in the realms of fantasy, certainly in terms of, you know, the oil revenues and so on. But basically, what you're dealing with are people, you know, who everybody wants something better. They want things to be better than they are. And, you know, what nationalism does is to persuade them the way to be better is to be apart. If what you see around you don't like, then it's, you know, it's tempting to go down that way. It's very, you know, rational arguments, or what I might consider a rational argument, you know, it can sometimes make it very difficult to make headway against the power of the heart, the emotional argument. Now, you see, Brexit was a lot of it was the same thing. You know, it's nationalism in a different form. The problem is that, you know, the world over, you usually find that the same problems are around after as were before. And, of course, referendums are very, very divisive. You know, the idea that the country unites after it, I think, is fanciful.
So it's interesting the comparison there between the Better Together campaign and Vote Remain. The Better Together campaign won, despite arguing for maintenance of the status quo. So what do you think that the campaign did better than Vote Remain in its message, its picturing, which then allowed it to win?
Well, it was a better campaign, though, I say it myself. And one of the reasons it was better is we spent a year finding out what people thought, not just in terms of how would you vote tomorrow if there was a referendum, but, you know, what we found, you know, and the nationalist polling shows exactly the same thing, and that, as you could see the campaign wearing on, we were both going for the same group, is there are a group of people who believe that Scotland should be separate as a matter of principle. Come what may, they're not going to get shifted. And equally, you'll find a slightly larger number on the union side, if you like. What you've got in the middle are various groups of people who, a lot of them tend towards saying, well, why shouldn't Scotland be on its own? But the thing that held them back was the fact that, hold on, there might be a cost here. And, you know, some of the promises that are being made, you know, seem, you know, a bit optimistic. Mm. Now, that won at that time. There's also some complications, of course. You know, if you've got a government that appears to be, you know, hostile to you or out of tune with what you think, if you don't see any chance of things changing, you know, that can change. Equally, you know, in Scotland now, the SNP have been in power for over 10 years, and people are beginning to notice that our educational standards are declining, you know, where they shouldn't be. We've got problems in transport, police, huge problems in the health service, and so on. So it, you know, it's a heady mix. But in some ways, you know, it's, you know, Brexit and, you know, nationalism, it's the same thing, that if you can get people's eyes off the day-to-day problems and say, there's the promised land. Mm. And the other thing you'd need is a functioning opposition.
Okay.
Which, just at the moment, we don't have.
How do you think that the Better Together campaign would have fared against the Dominic Cummings-esque strategies of doing things like, you know, putting a big number on the side of a bus or a very social media-driven campaign?
Well, on the social media thing, remember, it's hard to believe that only 6 years ago it was very much less developed than it is today. Although, you know, it was used, and obviously you have to use a lot more than that. I think that the lesson you learn from, you know, the bus is that, and this is changing, and I think really to the detriment of the, not just this country, but others, and that is, you know, that people can tell a lie now, and when challenged, you just repeat it. And challenge again, you tell a bigger one. And what people remember is the number.
Yeah.
And the rest of it's all politicians arguing. But, you know, and I think you need to be aware in any future contest, you know, that's going to happen again. I mean, you know, this isn't peculiar to the UK. And if you look at, you know, whether it was, you know, take back control or whether we get Brexit done, they're very simple. Rationally, you say, but they're grossly misleading. But if the music on the other side is not attractive, and I think, you know, I can't tell you what the next, any future referendum is going to say, and I hope, actually, I don't want to see another referendum anywhere. But, you know, you have to run your campaign to suit the circumstances of the day or the time. You can't really, you know, plan it ahead.
And what do you think the Labour Party's response to this should be, where you see the right with its simplistic messaging and then also shifting leftwards economically? How do you think that Labour should respond by shifting rightwards culturally?
No, I mean, the Labour Party, you know, is basic arguments of fairness, you know, opportunity for everyone. I mean, you know, go back to when we used to win elections, you know, in 1997, for example. Opportunity for all is a very simple message. And, you know, it's not complex. And, of course, you can say, oh, well, do you mean everybody? And what do you mean? How's it going to work? And so on. You know, I just think you have to be imaginative. You know, if you look at the most recent general election in the UK in December last year, part of where it went wrong was if you promise so much that nobody actually knows what it is, but it sounds an awful lot and it seems, you know, too good to be true, then it doesn't work. I mean, you've got an overlay with other things too there. But, you know, it's not about changing your, abandoning any principles you've got, or, you know, changing your message or getting wildly different policies. Politics is about convincing people that your idea to make things better would work. And then it's up to you to then articulate that in a way that people will understand. All I would say is that it is much easier to explain a policy in a sentence than it is in a page of A4. Because you don't tend to keep people's attention for quite that long. But it's not rocket science, this. But you actually do need people who are capable of doing it.
Okay, so then just to wrap up, conscious of time, it's been a lot of doom and gloom kind of talking about the financial crisis and everything fracturing apart. What gives you hope?
Well, I suppose the eternal hope is that the world carries on, you know, and there are ups and downs. There always have been, and my guess is there always will be. I do worry, you know, for the next, it seems to me, the next decade or so, this tendency to draw in among to ourselves, to become more nationalistic, to eschew the possibilities of working together is going to be dominant. But that's going to continue till somebody makes the argument that actually it makes sense to cooperate in some things. Some things you do best yourself, some things you do best with somebody else. But it what it needs is people who can capture the public imagination. Mm. And if you look in the UK, if you look at the two, you know, big shifts in the latter part of the 20th century. You had Margaret Thatcher and you had, you know, Tony Blair, both of whom could galvanise public opinion. And, you know, of course things go wrong and so on. But, you know, you've got to capture the mood. And that's why, you know, there will come another generation who can do that. But it needs to come fairly soonish.
So that's what gives you hope. It's the notion that the next, the cooperation is always the secret.
I think most people know that, you know, from their own experiences, there's times when you do need to cooperate. The NHS is a classic example of where you can provide much better, much more effectively for us all together contributing to a scheme than you ever will with a whole series of private arrangements and so on. And equally, people understand that, you know, countries come together for a reason, because, you know, to defend people and look after people. So, you know, it just needs, you know, you need people who are able to articulate that. And it will come again. But you know, it would be quite nice if it came sooner rather than later.
Perfect. Well, it makes a lot of sense. Ars Starling, thank you very much for your time. And thank you for coming on today. And thank you for the chat.
Thank you.
Cool.
And to you, the listener, we thank you for listening. And we hope you tune in again next time.